Electronic monitoring, lockdown, drug treatment centers, house arrest, mandated psychiatric treatment, data-driven surveillance, extended probations. These are just some of the key alternatives held up as cost-effective substitutes for jails and prisons, but many of these so-called reforms actually widen the net, weaving in new strands of punishment and control and bringing new populations who would not otherwise have been subject to imprisonment under physical control by the state. As mainstream public opinion has begun to turn against mass incarceration, political figures on both sides of the spectrum are pushing for reform. But though they're promoted as steps to confront high rates of imprisonment, many of these measures are transforming our homes and communities into prisons instead. In their new book, Prison by Any Other Name, activist journalists Maya Shenhwar and Victoria Waugh reveal the way the kinder, gentler narrative of reform can obscure agendas of social control and challenge us to question the ways we replicate the status quo when pursuing change. We welcome Maya Shenhwar and Victoria Waugh to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks so much for having us.
The name of the book, again, Prison by Any Other Name, The Harmful Consequences of Popular Reforms. Maya, let us begin with you. Talk a little bit about how we came to this reform movement in the first place.
So over the past few years, there's been a turn in the politics around incarceration. For decades, we've been seeing a lot of support for law and order politics, putting more and more people in prison, waging a war on drugs. But recently, thanks to the persistent long-term efforts of grassroots activists, people have been recognizing that the United States, having the largest prison population in the world, particularly incarcerating Black and brown people, is not actually something to be proud of. And plus, there's obviously been more awareness and pushback against the violence and racism of policing. But much of what politicians and mainstream Democratic and Republican thinkers are proposing to deal with these things are minor reforms to policing and prisons that will not actually change the oppressive roots of the system, including white supremacy, colonialism, economic injustice, all of those things. So we discuss in our book the ways that many reforms, like some of the ones you mentioned, electronic monitoring, psychiatric hospitals, lockdown drug treatment centers, simply offer prison alternatives that are replacements for prison. They don't actually shrink the system. And we see this happening on all sides of the aisle. We see conservatives like Newt Gingrich and the Koch brothers and Grover Norquist also getting into this advocacy. But we want to challenge that kind of replacement-oriented reform, looking at the dangerous ramifications of those alternatives and how they're actually replicating the punitive practices and the isolation and the confinement and the surveillance of prison and hurting larger numbers of marginalized people.
So let's talk about some of those dangerous ramifications. The subtitle, Victoria, of the book is The Harmful Consequences of Popular Reforms. What do we know about the harmful and dangerous nature of these reforms?
Well, as Maya said, what we're seeing is not alternatives that actually address social and economic problems that cause many people to be funneled into the criminal legal system. And instead, what we're seeing are alternatives that just function as punishment. But at the same time, so what we're seeing is people being confined to their homes, to a lockdown drug treatment center, not being able to participate fully in their families and their communities. If they have jobs and they are sentenced to a drug treatment center, they often lose their jobs because most jobs do not hold on to your job for 6 or more months. What we're also seeing, at least in the case of electronic monitoring and sometimes with probation, is that people have to pay for their own surveillance and monitoring. And failure to pay these costs, which add up to quite a lot. One person we talked to paid $115 a month for her electronic monitoring, and that cost kept snowballing and was told at the end of her sentence that her sentence would be extended until her, until she had made all of her payments. Another person was told that if he did not pay all of the costs by the time his sentence ended, he would be sent to jail, and then upon release from jail would still be responsible for paying that amount of money. So we're seeing this also target people with very, very few or no income and resources. So people like Harvey Weinstein and Jeffrey Epstein are the exceptions that make the news. But for the most part, people who are targeted by this are people who are marginalized, who are black, brown, low income, poor, and don't have the resources to be able to survive and thrive in society. And at the same time, we're seeing these same monies and resources being sucked out of these same communities. So these are often communities that don't have proper grocery stores or access to healthy and nutritious food. These are communities where the schools are overcrowded and have a hiring freeze on teachers and have more security guards than they do counselors, if they have counselors at all. So, and these are also communities that are often over-policed and under-resourced in so many other ways.
I'm interested in both of you weighing in on this, but we'll begin with you, Maya. After slavery ended with the 13th Amendment, you point out in the book that incarceration rates rose precipitously, and you say that those two phenomena were connected intimately. Give us a sense of that backstory and in what way.
So the 13th Amendment to the Constitution does outlaw slavery, but it contains an exception for, quote, punishment for crime. And I'm sure some people have seen the documentary 13th. The prison population increased substantially after slavery ended, and black people in particular were arrested for all kinds of things, including things that hadn't previously been crimes, like curfew violations or so-called loitering. And in prisons, people were sometimes required to do hard labor without pay. And even when they weren't required to do labor, these prisons were deeply connected to slavery. And I think in Angela Davis's book, Are Prisons Obsolete?, she talks about how prisons at that point in history became punishment attached not to crime, but to race. And this is just one of the threads that led to the growth of prisons. We see that racialized punishment extending upward in the mid to late 20th century after Jim Crow fell, at least in name, and the civil rights laws were passed. Prison then became another route to maintaining institutional racism, maintaining the racial caste system, as Michelle Alexander discusses it. And that system ballooned. We saw the drug war, expanded prosecution of drug offenses. And today, we still see black Americans disproportionately policed and prosecuted and arrested and incarcerated and also surveilled in all these other ways that we've been discussing through electronic monitoring, through predictive policing that targets black neighborhoods and other neighborhoods of color. Black Americans are still nearly five times as likely as white people to be incarcerated. And so we see this legacy that incarceration is not only disproportionately targeting black communities and other communities of color, there's other legacies. There's the legacy of indigenous genocide, too, and the ways in which incarceration targets immigrant communities. But not only is this about disproportionate arrest, disproportionate incarceration, it's about this system having been built on a foundation of white supremacy that has risen up from those roots in slavery in particular.
Anything you'd like to add to that, Victoria?
Yes, prisons and these prison alternatives that we write about also disappear populations that are considered surplus. So, you know, so even though it's rooted in a system of colonialism and genocide and white supremacy, the system expands itself to sweep up people that are considered undesirable in some way. So even though we look at the roots of the prison system as part of a racial caste order, we're seeing that other populations who are considered undesirable or not wanted or surplus also get swept up into this. So this is why we also see people who are low income of other races being swept up into this. We're seeing people who are trans and gender nonconforming disproportionately targeted for arrest and incarceration. And so this is not necessarily for listeners, because we are in the Northeast, who think, well, I am not black, why should I care about this? You know, this is a system that just keeps expanding, so that way what happens to another marginalized population eventually expands itself so that it sweeps other people into its net, and at the same time doesn't keep society safer. As Maya mentioned earlier, we have 25% of the world's prison population, but 5% of the world's actual population. And if prisons kept us safer, or these prison alternatives, we should be the safest nation in the world. And instead, we are not, because we're not actually addressing people's basic needs.
One of the points that you make in the book, Maya, is you look also at psychiatric institutions, because they are distinct today, but you say they evolve together and in many ways mirror each other. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Absolutely. So people see psychiatric institutions as often these alternatives to prison that are so obvious, because so many people who are incarcerated are diagnosed with mental illness.
Right.
And that's problematic in a couple of ways. One of them is that mental illness diagnoses are assigned based on certain behaviors and certain reported emotions that many, many, many people experience in prison, because prison is traumatic. So prison drives the kind of trauma that leads to psychiatric disabilities and psychiatric diagnoses. Another thing that I think we have to keep in mind is prison arose as a reform. It was originally brought up as this idea that could address the fact that punishment at the time was so based around physical punishment, including capital punishment. And so prison was considered a humane alternative, this process of isolating people. And for religiously minded reformers, this was supposed to bring people closer to God. There were all kinds of ways in which prison itself was seen as a kinder and gentler alternative. And psychiatric institutions actually arose in a similar manner, where initially we saw people with psychiatric disabilities being locked up by their family members in sheds or attics. We saw family members even being killed or just cast out or beaten in all kinds of different ways. And so psychiatric institutions arose as what was supposed to be a humane reform that proposed confinement as the solution to brutal physical violence. But of course, we see the ways in which both prison and psychiatric institutions, which often use some of the same methods, actually do manifest as violence, that putting a human being in a cage of any kind is a type of violence. And we've seen again and again, the research shows us that you can't offer people treatment inside of an involuntary cage. So when you are confining people coercively and then saying, okay, here is some medication, here is a social worker, here is a psychiatrist, that's not actually the way you address people's underlying trauma. And very often you're then piling more trauma on top of what people have already experienced. Many of the people we interviewed described their experiences in psychiatric hospitals in ways that very much mirrored the experience of prison, being sexually abused, physically abused, denied just basic human rights. And of course, this isn't true for everyone, and some people do voluntarily enter a psychiatric hospital. So we're not saying that people should not be able to choose their own treatment. We're talking about coercion. We're talking about the kind of involuntary confinement that is often offered. Yes.
I apologize. We are running out of time, so I'm sorry to cut you off. But the name of the book is Prison by Any Other Name, The Harmful Consequences of Popular Reforms, Maya Shenhua and Victoria Law. I thank you very much. The book is published by The New Press. Thank you for being with us. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.